coming up on Bookshelfie.
It is funny. Yeah. I love books which have murder and are also funny. I really enjoyed it, and I just love the humour. Like, there were a few times where I was like snorting to myself because I was like, yes, this is hilarious. Murder is funny. A lot of last year I was on set a lot of the time, whereas like when I'm actually writing a project, it's literally just me in my pyjamas at my desk. So I feel like that's when I'm most relatable, when I'm my most disgusting. And it's just pure creative and just pure writing. This book got me, the plot twist. I was like, ooh! Couldn't breathe. I was like, oh, you wily minx, you got me with that one. It was such... And I actually think this book didn't just have one big major plot twist where everyone goes like, oh, shut up. I think it had two of them, and I think it pulled them off expertly. I think a lot of the time, the interests of teenage girls are looked down upon by other people, and I think they're stupid, because I think, if anything, teenage girls... they go through something.
They're the smartest among us.
They're the smartest.
Hello, I'm Vic Hope, and this is Bookshelfie, the podcast from the Women's Prize that asks women with lives as inspiring as any fiction to share the five books by women that have shaped them. Now, before we begin, remember to subscribe or follow so you never miss an episode, with thanks to our sponsor, Baileys. Today, I am joined by a superstar of crime fiction, Holly Jackson. Holly sold over 10 million copies of her books worldwide, with translations in 45 different languages. She's often described as the Taylor Swift of books and has cultivated a loyal following and highly engaged global fan base. A Good Girl's Guide to Murder has spent over 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list, and the series is now a major BBC and Netflix production, with season 2 due for release very, very soon. Holly's other novels include Five Survive and The Reappearance of Rachel Price, and the paperback of her adult fiction debut, Not Quite Dead Yet, is out on the 7th of May. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for that big introduction. I feel a bit like Khaleesi from Game of Thrones, where they just have so many monikers for her and you're listing them and everyone's like, yeah, get to it now.
How does it feel when someone lists back the accolades, the
achievements? I get shy, and then I'm like, no, that wasn't me. And then I'm like, 10 million people have read my... Oh, yeah. My God, don't perceive me. Gosh, just 2 people had read it.
We were just talking, actually, about being perceived, more because this podcast is now visualised. So hello if you're watching on YouTube.
So I had to put mascara on.
And I. Rude. And I wouldn't usually.
No.
Because, personally, I mean, I do radio. I do some TV, but I like being on the radio because...
Don't need mascara.
Just, exactly. Yeah. You can just get on with it and you're just chatting. How do you feel being perceived? You have so many fans, so many readers. And isn't that the point, to put these books into the world?
Yeah, but then there is that like existential dread that people are reading something that you wrote. And like, actually, to be honest, I have sort of grown a bit of a thick skin about it. And I'd say my attitude now has almost gone the reverse, in which sometimes I go on Goodreads and seek out the bad reviews, and I find them funny. I like reading them.
That seems like quite a healthy way.
I don't think it's healthy, okay.
But to find them funny rather than hurtful.
Yeah, I find them funny. But like, I've got really thick skin now. Nothing you can say, I'd just be like, yeah, whatever. You're probably right.
Well,
don't care.
You can't take it personally because it's not you. It's for a start, it's a book that you wrote and that is now being taken on board by the reader. Mm. It ain't my fault.
It's your fault, reader.
Exactly. It's up to them to do what they will with it.
Mm, exactly.
I mean, you've become something of a role model for young women, aspiring writers, with the runaway success of your books and the TV adaptations as well. How has it been navigating that sort of level of fame, as it were?
It's tricky. I would say, like, my day-to-day life, I mean, pick any sort of week in the year and ask me what I'm up to, is always really different. There's not really a schedule per se. Like, a lot of last year I was on set a lot of the time, whereas like when I'm actually writing a project, it's literally just me in my pajamas at my desk. So I feel like that's when I'm most relatable, when I'm my most disgusting. And it's just pure creative and just pure writing. I do have a few pinch me moments where I'm like, oh, this is so random. We're making a TV show of that thing I just wrote randomly and sent it off. So, yeah, I don't think I've really like appreciated how mad it is, because it's just work to me. Like, it feels like work. Mm. And so when I'm like getting up at 5 a.m. to trek it down to set on season two, sometimes I forget to be like, oh my God, this is actually really cool, because it does just become work. And inevitably, work is always boring. So yeah. Newsflash, TV shows, boring.
Prefer writing?
I like the balance between the both, because I think when I'm writing a book, it is very much just me. Like, I know I have my agents and editors who I can ask questions to whenever I want to, but I tend not to. I tend to just completely cave troll. Like, I've got no one to ask, like, does this sound like this is going to work? It's literally like just me talking to myself. And sometimes it does feel a bit like lonely. And I like my own company. I'm a good type. But there is an element where I think TV show, because it's so much more collaborative and you're working with so many people, it takes a village. I think it's a nice balance of like forcing me out of my comfort zone and sort of like with other people and seeing what other creative minds can bring to the process. So I quite like doing both. I think I want to, moving forward, obviously still keep doing books every year, but also adaptations. I really enjoy it, and hopefully I'm good at it. We'll see when season two comes out.
I like that, the balance, the flexing of the different muscles. But I also really like that you describe being in your pajamas and writing as pure creative, pure disgusting.
Yeah, pure. When I'm doing my best work, I'm my most disgusting.
Yeah,
I haven't washed my hair in like 3 weeks.
All the better for
you. You can take out the scrunchie and it stays in the top knot. That's what we're talking about.
And the words on the page are...
they're golden.
Yes.
Those metaphors are singing.
Well, your latest book, Not Quite Dead Yet, it's your first for adult readers. Has that experience been different for you? Has it felt like your readers have grown with you?
To be honest, it's not different at all.
Right.
It's like the exact same process as writing my YA books. Literally, I go through the same thing of structuring the plot where the midpoint hit. Like, it's the same. I have to find a character journey for the main character. The only thing is that the main character is 27, not 17. And I'm allowed to use my favourite swear word, which you're not allowed to use in YA books.
What's your favourite?
I don't think you want me to say it.
I think
loud.
I do.
It rhymes with... hunt.
Got it.
Mm-hmm.
My favourite too.
Everyone's favourite word. Very risky putting that in an American book set in America, though.
They don't like it. They think it's really bad.
They don't throw it around quite the same way that we do. So it was a risk, but I like risks.
Well, from your favourite swear word to your favourite books, we're going to delve into the books that have shaped
what
you, that
segue.
You've loved.
That was, what a brilliant segue.
I hope I can keep it up, actually. I'm quite proud of that. Pure creative, pure disgusting. Your first book, Shelfie book, is The Time Traveller's Wife.
Yes.
By Audrey Niffenegger. Henry is a librarian who suffers from a rare condition where his genetic clock periodically resets, suddenly finding himself pulled through time into his past or future. Meanwhile, Claire is an artist waiting all her life for her great love, Henry, to appear. In the face of this force, which neither can prevent nor control, Henry and Claire struggle to lead normal lives. Multi-award-winning, internationally best-selling, and adapted for film, TV, and into a musical, The Time Traveller's Wife is an extraordinary tale of love which transcends the boundaries of time and was longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2004.
I'm very glad you did that summary, by the way, because I have forgotten most of this book that I put down as a really important book to me.
And almost died doing it.
Yeah, I know.
But thank you for your service. We've got it.
Yeah.
This is a formative influence, you've said, in the past. How old were you when you came across this book?
I think young. I think wait, when was it published?
Well, it was 2004 that it was longlisted.
Yes,
so, yeah.
I think I was like 13 or 14 when I read it. Or younger? Like, I could have been 12. I don't think I was probably allowed to read it. I have a lot of that. Like, I was reading Stephen King's It when I was 11. Just bad parental supervision. But, yeah, I think I was... young. So I think this might have been like one of the first adult books that I really read. And it was sort of like my first experience of books feeling a bit more like real life, because I guess up until that point, I'd read a lot of like middle grade fantasy, like those big series like your Harry Potters or the Edgewood Chronicles was another series that I loved. And I do think I found my dad's thriller stash early on, like Harlan Coben books, and read those when I was too young. But I think this might have been like my first literary. I mean, I guess it's sort of literary with speculative elements. But to me, it was the first time I read something that felt like more real life, she says in inverted commas, because it's about time traveler's wife. But I think that's why I remember it so vividly, because I was like, oh, you don't have to be set in a completely different made up world where there's lots of different rules about, like, this stories can be about real people. And essentially, even though this book, obviously, it's about time travel and paradoxes and all that stuff, but essentially, it's about a relationship and like a marriage. Yeah. And like, as much as I remember, it's sort of relatable in that way, and it feels like real life. So I think that's why I cling to it as like an example of, just because a book feels like real life and might be more quote unquote boring, doesn't mean that it has to be.
Those recognizable tropes and themes and characters that we then can see in ourselves, and we can put ourselves into these worlds as well. They don't have to be so far removed from our reality.
Yeah.
It's quite a revelation, actually.
Yeah.
And when you did read that, say you were 12, 13, can you remember what you were like? What was going on in your worlds when this world landed?
Not really. I mean, I think I already knew I sort of had the writer gene, as it were. I'm doing this a lot. This is obviously the thing of the day. Thank God this is a film podcast.
Quote unquote.
Quote unquote.
For those of you who are just listening.
Oh, yeah. Basically, picture me just doing bunny ear fingers the entire time around every single word, like this as well. What was I talking about? Now I've been distracted.
What you were like when you were young.
Yeah, I think I already knew I was going to be a writer, hopefully. Otherwise, who knows what I would have done. Like, I remember very vividly, like, being on the playground, even when I was like 8, 9, 10, and other children would come up for me to write their like playtime stories.
Oh, so you were known as the oracle writer.
Yeah, I was like I was like a pimp for stories to the other children.
That's an amazing image.
But they weren't playing with me. They came over to be like, can you tell me, like, give us a scenario. Okay, the main character does this and he's fighting. And they're like, great, cool. And then they run off and go play it and just leave me to watch the creation.
Role to play.
I know.
I was in the playground.
I would say that I was director, though, because I was watching from afar. But
orchestrating it all.
Not allowed to actually play, but
I was giving everyone a little sniff of my Vicks.
Were you?
Yeah, that was my role.
Contraband, bringing contraband into school.
And everyone lining up, five pence,
here
you go.
I do love the smell of Vicks, though. Mm. Yeah. We would have been buddies.
Well, you're telling fun stories. And
you drug people with the Vic smell, get them all nice and calm and soothed by the menthol.
I read that you wrote your first book at 15.
Yeah, what a loser.
Not a loser. That's amazing.
And it's really bad. I don't think it survived on my hard drive. I was actually getting distracted last week and looking at what I still had on my computer. And I think that book probably was on an old machine that's now dead. Thank God, because I did worry about me dying young and tragically and glamorously and someone trying to publish that post my death. And oh God, I would have haunted all of you who read it.
You're not proud of it?
It's just, like, to be fair, I'm proud of young Holly for being, like, it was a full book. It was like over 100,000 words. So, like, what a kino, like, back then. I showed that I had the gumption to get to the end of a book. It's just very, very, like, derivative of the kind of fantasy stories I was enjoying. Like, very much about some sort of MacGuffin, like, there's a magic sword we have to go get three parts and then defeat all evil. So right now I would be like, that's very, you know, black and white. I prefer morally grey areas now. But, you know, kudos to young me for doing it. But I hope it never sees the light of day, or I'm going to be so upset.
I know that fans of The Time Traveler's Wife are very, very excited at the moment because the sequel, which is publishing later this year.
Wait, what?
I was going to ask you if you were excited, but I feel like I've just given you an exclusive.
Plot twist. You have just given me an exclusive. I didn't know there was a sequel.
Life Out of Order is the story of Henry and Claire's daughter.
I was going to say,
Alba.
They have a kid, don't they? Oh, yes,
and
that will be interesting.
Audrey's been working on it for 13 years.
Oh, that makes sense, because if the original came out in 2003, then maybe she was waiting the length of the daughter's life.
I don't know. We'll have to read it. Will you?
Oh, I definitely will.
Yeah.
That is breaking news.
We'll reconvene.
I'm so excited. I don't think I even ever saw the film adaptation. Or maybe I did. Maybe it just came out a while ago. Again, I have a memory like a sieve. So even though I've listed all these books as being formative to my younger years, I can't really remember all that much about what happens.
Well, let's see what you remember about your second book, Shelfie Book.
Okay, good luck to me.
Which is Beloved by Toni Morrison. Sorry, before you came in the room, you were like, and there's dragons in Beloved by Toni Morrison.
That was me saying, good luck with what I actually recall. I recall this one slightly better than Time Traveler's Wife.
Well, first published in 1987, Beloved is Toni Morrison's best known and widely considered her greatest work, exploring the devastating legacy of slavery. Terrible, unspeakable things happened to Seth at Sweet Home, the farm where she lived as a slave for so many years until she escaped to Ohio. Her new life is full of hope, but 18 years later, she is still not free. Seth's new home is not only haunted by the memories of her past, but also by the ghost of her baby, who died nameless and whose tombstone is engraved with just a single word, Beloved. Now, she is, Toni Morrison, an established favourite here at the Women's Prize. Shortlisted for Paradise in 1999, often selected by our guests. Why did you pick this one of her novels?
So I read Beloved, I think I was 17, 18, and I think I was studying it in English in school. So I think I must have written an essay about it, which is why I think I recall it more than other books I might have read, because I think I must have reread it a few times. And to me, Beloved is quite hard to describe because I guess you would call it literary fiction, but it's also kind of speculative, but like subtly and groundedly like there's a ghost.
Yeah.
And I do love ghosts. And I just remember, I think this is probably the first time I was reading a book and just bowled over by the prose, by like how much of a master Toni Morrison was with words. Like, read a paragraph and then have to sit back and be like, wow.
Yeah.
And not in a way that like took you out of the book, although I was studying it for an essay, so I think it's okay. I probably read it first to read it and then probably went through very like semantically and analytically. But the way that she could make you feel or attempt to feel how these characters are feeling was like, I think, a revelation to me of being like, oh, okay, now this is a writer. And I remember like lots of probably very technical, complicated narrative tricks that she's doing. Like, it's a third person omniscient narrator, but it sort of slips between some of the characters. And this might be me misremembering, so I apologize if it is, but I seem to remember she's so masterful at the way the perspective shifts. It would be like Setha would be in a scene with Paul D, I think was the character, and they would touch in the scene somehow, and like that would transfer the narrative voice from Setha to Paul D. And it was just so, in the way that it just knew exactly what it was doing. It wasn't formulaic, you know, it slips between the present and the past all the time, if I remember correctly. All of this caveated with, if I remember correctly.
No, you're spot on. I reread it just last year when I was pregnant, which was a strange choice.
But considering what happens in that book, it's a choice.
Very, very strange. Mm. But the same experience of just, how are you writing like that?
How
but it never
so
getting in the
good?
Way of reading it.
If anything, it gets you into it so much more.
Yeah.
I was just thinking like another writer, a weaker writer, could have taken this and been really formulaic with like present day, now we go to the past. And the way that Toni Morrison was able to like weave them together so that sometimes you're in a scene and there'll be like, I don't know, a sight or a smell that reminds the character of something in the past. And then it rips you back into there. I think, A, it just made the reading experience so, like, it felt like you were almost in a stream of consciousness. You didn't have to be like, okay, present chapter, past chapter. And I think helped with the theme of, you know, like the past, just trying to forget that something happened isn't a way to move on. And you sort of have to like reckon with what happened in order to hopefully become a more developed character and move on and hopefully find some semblance of happiness. And I just thought everything about it was so considered. Like, again, I might be wrong. I think this is right. I think the very first word of the book, I think, is 124, which is the house they live in. And it says something like 124 was quiet or loud or something. I wish I'd looked this up. And I remember thinking, obviously not on my first read, on rereads that I returned to, it's so smart, because if you know what happens in this book, there's a certain family structure and oh no, you said it, and that's not spoilers. One of her children, yeah, beloved, has died.
We won't go into necessarily how. Yeah.
But beloved, if you count one and two as the parents, three, beloved would have been the third member of the family, and four, their child Denver is around. But because beloved is dead, three has gone, so it's only one, two, and four left.
There's the two boys as well, but they've left.
Maybe I haven't described it exactly, but I feel like there was something in the 124 at the start that I was like, oh.
Yeah.
And when you look through, knowing what you know will happen later with beloved, you sort of look through and you're like, oh, damn it. Toni Morrison's so clever, the way that she's considered like every single word, every single comma has been considered.
The word economy of it is exquisite. And the ability to get me to understand the justification for the worst possible thing you could do.
Yeah.
Because of the pain, to describe pain in a way that is so palpable, to describe horror in that way, to really explore what it means to be free in the socioeconomic, political setting, but also inside oneself. And to do that, just like you say, to go between the micro, the macro, it's just, oh, it's masterful.
She's the master.
She's the master.
She quite literally is. And I think, I believe this might have been when I was still living with my parents, because I think my copy of the book is there. I need to go and rescue it and bring it into my house. But I think I remember sometimes when I was maybe writing, it might have been before I wrote A Good Girl's Guide to Murder, but I do think sometimes I just went and would just pick a page at random and just read it and be like, that's what good writing is. Try and do that. Not that I could ever do what Toni Morrison
did. But has she
did.
Been like an influence, an inspiration?
Yeah, I would say for sure. That book I hold like very dear, as not only what it is and how it makes you feel and the characters, I think just also the slightly more nerdy and analytical side, which is just how masterful it is at things like perspective and point of view and making you understand a character who did what people might think is the most heinous thing, and you going, yeah, I know, I get it. Yeah.
Morrison actually once said that writing is to me an advanced and slow form of reading. And it sounds a little bit like that's something that you find as well. If you do go into a book, and her book in particular, and pick out a page and sort of analyze the way that she's written in your reading, you're becoming more of a writer in all of these different forms that you also can sort of master. There's such diverse influences on her writing, and I'm sure in yours as well. Does it resonate with your approach to writing?
I think so. I mean, at the moment, because of the way my books have been more genre focused and their single point of view, means that I haven't necessarily been able to learn the lessons that Toni Morrison taught me on perspective and point of view. But actually, I have a few future projects which I think will be multi-POV, and I'm hoping, not that I could ever come anywhere close to what Toni Morrison can pull off, but that's where I think I will finally get to apply some of the lessons that she's taught me. I need to go rescue my copy of the book so that I can leaf through it and just read one of her paragraphs and just be like, wow, I could never, but I will try my hardest.
This episode of Bookshelfie is sponsored by Baileys. Baileys is proudly supporting the 2026 Women's Prize for Fiction, helping showcase incredible writing by remarkable women, celebrating their accomplishments and getting more of their books into the hands of more people. Baileys is the perfect adult treat, whether shaken in a cocktail, over ice cream, or paired with your favourite book. Check out baileys.com for our favourite Baileys recipes. Well, on to another favourite here at the Women's Prize. Your third bookshelfy book is Fingersmith by Sarah Waters. Shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2002.
Have I managed to pick all books that were shortlisted?
Just ones that we love as well.
Oh my God, I didn't even, like, I wasn't even trying that, guys.
Fingersmith is a tale of fraud, insanity and secrets. In 1862, Sue Trinder, orphaned at birth, grows up among London's petty thieves, Fingersmiths. Under the rough but loving care of Mrs. Suxby and her, quote unquote, I'm doing the fingers as well, family. But from the moment Sue draws breath, her fate is linked to that of another orphan growing up in a gloomy mansion not too many miles away. Now, you've described this book as a work of genius. Tell us about this choice. Where does the genius lie in this novel for you?
I mean, again, this is another one I must have read when I was a teenager. What year did it come out?
2002.
Yeah, so I was 10 then, or 9 or 10. So I picked it up a bit later, but I think I was a teenager. And I think, first of all, I just have a thing for, like, Victorian London. I don't know why. I just think it's cool.
It is cool.
It's like, if I could be reincarnated in an... Would I want? Maybe not. They didn't have, like, flushing toilets and... Wi-Fi.
There'll be some things you'd have to sacrifice. Yeah.
If I could visit for like a week, I'd be happy. Just like going around and... Anyway, I'm getting carried away. And being a thief. I've always thought that there's something really cool about thieves. I just find something really cool about... Because, you know, it's sort of a slightly more forgivable crime than murder.
Yeah.
There's just something...
Petty.
It's breaking news. I find thieves cool. Fictional thieves, not... Not real life thieves.
Oh, yeah, robbers.
Yeah, robbers.
Don't say robbers enough, do we?
Like, there's just something about thieves that, like, also, like, pirates, I think, are cool, even though they're objectively probably not. And they did some heinous things other than being pirates. But I find thieves really fun. And I remember reading Fingersmith and, like, there was the biggest plot twist ever that I think probably I was reading this when I was a teenager and I hadn't quite so obsessively started studying story and reading so widely and watching so much. So I was probably a bit more of a novice. Nowadays, it would be fun to know if it would get me, but this book got me. The plot twist, I was like, couldn't breathe. I was like, oh, you wily minx, you got me with that one. It was such... And I actually think this book didn't just have one big major plot twist where everyone goes like, shut up. I think it had two of them. And I think it pulled them off expertly. And I just remember being like, oh, I love people going on some sort of heist and then all backstabbing each other. It's perfect. It's kind of like Victorian set Ocean's 11.
Yeah. Mm. And that setting is like a character in itself. Like Victorian London, like you say, it's explored and it's cool. What is it about Sarah Waters' historical world building that is so immersive and transporting?
I mean, I have so much respect for people who will write historical set stuff because it sounds like a lot of work to me.
It's a lot of research.
Yeah, like so much, because I guess in any given sentence you're applying your 21st century brain. I mean, the obvious stuff is obvious, like they don't have mobile phones, but I feel like just in general you might be talking about, like, I don't know, the shelves are made of walnut, and then you might be like, wait, did we import walnut? Yeah, I'm gonna have, like, the amount of research and second guessing you must have to go through in order to pull that off. But I'm so thankful that other authors are willing to do that for me. I don't know that I could write a historical, but I think you can just tell the level of detail that's gone into essentially every single description and paragraph, because she's probably had to research it. And I think it really does, like, transport you to that setting, which is so important to this book. But again, as I said, I've got a soft spot for Victorian London. So recently I did such a nerdy thing. I watched, this is going to make me look like such a weirdo, but I've done it now.
Don't worry about that.
There's these video games called Assassin's Creed,
yes,
where they're set in, like, various times in history. And there's one in Victorian London, but I watched a YouTube video that's not someone playing the game, like the missions, it's someone just walking around how they've rendered Victorian London and saying, like, well, this is you know, this station and here's some facts. And oh, the post box would have been green, not red at the time. And it was like 3 hours long, this video. And I just watched a fake assassin walking around Victorian London, England, the whole thing. I put it on double speed, though. No, I'm a double speeder.
That's what is there to be watched.
Exactly.
There's people watching it.
I don't know. It's interesting. To be honest, it was a pretty popular video. So it's like, if I've got that weird niche, then other people have
definitely.
I could be doing worse.
Hey, a lot of people have that. And I wouldn't even call it a weird niche. It's absolutely fascinating. And the book has a bit of a cult following. Mm. How have you found the fandom around A Good Girl's Guide to Murder?
I love them.
It's a pretty cool thing.
I think hopefully, touch wood, knock on wood, I think that my readers just happen to like really be cool. Mm. I don't think I deserve them, but they are really like, they get it. And often I say that when I'm writing a book, and this is the truth, I'm writing it for me, really. I'm writing something that I would love to pick up and read now, or would like to have picked up and read as a teenager. Or if, yeah, I'm selfish. Now I'm like, this is what I want to read, so I'm going to write it. And I'm really fortunate that so many people seem to also enjoy the same things that I do from a book, or want to explore the same kind of elements that they don't necessarily see already in fiction. Like, when I wrote A Good Girl's Guide to Murder, there wasn't a lot of like procedural crime fiction based around a teenage girl. And I think a lot of the time the interests of teenage girls are looked down upon by other people, and I think they're stupid, because I think, if anything, teenage girls, they go through something.
They're the smartest among us.
They're the smartest. And being a teenage girl, I think, prepares you for life in a way. It hardens your soul. And so, yeah, I think I'm writing for all of them. That's not to say that you only have to be a teenage girl to read my books. I actually think I am pulling this statistic out of my ass. There is absolutely no, I have no backing for this, but I think maybe the majority of my readers are actually women in their 20s and 30s, as well as like the teenage contingent. So I think there is a universality in wanting to see the slightly more morally grey, like allow women and girls to be unlikable and make bad choices like men have been allowed to do in fiction. Here I am on my soapbox. Like, men have been allowed to do in fiction forever.
And you have gone from, in your pyjamas, creative,
still often in my pyjamas,
writing something for yourself that you know you enjoy. How validating is it to know that actually you're not alone? There's a lot of people want to read that. A lot of people want to have those conversations. They want to devour those stories.
Yeah. Thank goodness. Otherwise, I'd have to find another job and I have no applicable skills. I don't know what I would do. But yeah, I am very lucky that there seem to be a whole bunch of weirdos who like the same stories as me. So I hope you will stay weird and I will keep working hard.
Well, let's find out about another story that you like. Your fourth book is My Sister, the Serial Killer.
I remember this one because I only read it recently.
There we go. Oyinka Braithwaite. This is brilliant. This is yet another Women's Prize shortlisted author. This is from 2019. Great choices. When Korede's dinner is interrupted one night by a distress call from her sister Ayola, Korede knows what is expected of her. Bleach, rubber gloves, nerves of steel, and a strong stomach. This will be the third boyfriend Ayula's dispatched in, quote, self-defense, and the third mess that her lethal little sibling has left Korede to clear away. She should probably go to the police for the good of the menfolk of Nigeria, but she loves her sister, and as they say, family always comes first. Until, that is, Ayula starts dating the doctor where Korede works as a nurse. Korede's long been in love with him and isn't prepared to see him wind up with a knife in his back. But to save one would mean sacrificing the other. Oh, it's a great twisty, plotty book. Tell us why you've chosen this novel.
I just love the drama. I don't know if you would classify... I guess it's a satire. It is funny.
Yeah.
I love books which have murder and are also funny. There's something that feels almost like melodrama about it to me. And you know, elements would be introduced. I'd be like, oh, I think I know where this is going. And then when it would happen, I'd be like, see, I told you. But I would be, I was just really invested. And I felt like the main character really felt accessible in the way that hopefully none of us, well, we may do. I'm not casting judgment. Most of us don't have the experience of our younger sister calling us up and saying, I've killed another one. Can you help me get rid of him? But the way that the main character, Caridi, was just felt so relatable that, like, as someone with a younger sister, we've never done any murders together, by the way. Just disclaimer.
Just to clear that up.
Just
because,
in case the police are listening. I never have, and neither has she.
We give these sort of prompts whenever we get guests on the show. And, you know, it's like, oh, a book you return to, a book that's a comfort read, a book that you recommend. This one is a book that feels pertinent in your life. And you chose this. And I was like, I saw your notes. I was like, oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it gave me so many good tips for covering up my crime, and my sister helped me. No, there haven't been any murders yet from my behalf, but this one, I just had a real blast reading it. Mm-hmm. And there are sometimes, like, I read a lot, and even if I'm not necessarily enjoying a book, I'm not much of a, what do they call it? A DNF-er. Did not finish.
I can't. I feel terrible.
I feel too terrible. Yeah. I have to get to the end. Like, even if I'm reading so slowly and it's ruined my love for reading for a good few months, I will get to the end. Like, I'm not a quitter. And I've had a bit of a bad reading year because I was stuck. I'm not going to obviously say which book it is, but I was stuck on this, like, heavy, hard science fiction trilogy that put me off for a while. And then this is the book that I read a few weeks after that. And I was like, oh, that was such a breeze. This is so fun. Like, reading is fun again.
I remember.
I really enjoyed it. And I just love the humor. Like, there were a few times where I was like snorting to myself because I was like, yes, this is hilarious. Murder is funny.
That dark humor. And it's interesting you mentioned the melodrama of it because it is set in Nigeria. It's Nollywood. Mm. It's giving Nollywood at times.
There were some characters who, I don't know if you would call them caricatures, but they were definitely like a heightened version of what they were. It did sort of feel like a soap opera, but so delicious, so brilliant.
As a writer of crime fiction yourself, I'm quite intrigued as to what you would do faced with Korode's dilemma.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because this book has like two of my absolute weak spots, which is relationships with sisters. I love books with like deep relationships with sisters and murder, which is funny.
Which way are we going to go?
So like, I know that the main character does face a sort of moral conundrum, and like, I'm with the main character as she's starting to question her sister and think, was this really self-defense? This isn't adding up. And then obviously the doctor that she's fancied for years, her little sister comes into work, catches his eye, and then the inevitable is, oh no, they're going to get together. And then she, so I'm with the main character as she's going through this journey, but in the end I was like, yeah, but that's your sister. So actually the way that the book ends, I was really into it. I was like, I don't think I could have ended it any other way. I don't think I would have wanted any other ending to just come back. It basically, the story sort of does a hero's journey where the main character goes through these steps, like recognizes what her sister is, tries to go on a journey, maybe change it. She actually does end up right where she started, having changed a bit and accepted that now she's in this cycle and there's not much she can do about it, because when she tried to intervene, it went terribly. And I just sort of love the, it's sort of like a bittersweet, hopeful-ish moment. I loved it.
Well, bittersweet, thanks to that dark humour, that sort of satirical commentary about the patriarchy as well. Mm. And you've spoken in the past about being inspired by true crime. This book certainly borrows from this. How do you feel about criticisms of true crime as voyeuristic or problematic?
I mean, I'm very aware. I consume a lot of true crime. Well, actually, not for a while, but in previous years, like when I'm out walking the dog or whatever, I'll be listening to a true crime podcast. And it certainly has fed into a lot of my books, particularly The Reappearance of Rachel Price, which sort of has a critique about true crime and us seeing it as entertainment and not realizing that it's real lives behind it. I mean, I have conflicting opinions because I guess there is something in the fact that so much of us want to consume true crime.
Yeah.
And again, I'm pulling another statistic out of my bum from nowhere, but I feel like a lot of the people who consume true crime are women. So there is part of me that wonders, is it not necessarily just for entertainment? Is there an element of almost like self-preservation, like listening to what is the worst that can happen so you can sort of prepare or spot the signs?
Sometimes fiction and real life, pretty interchangeable.
Exactly.
And real life feels wilder than fiction and vice versa. Yeah, there
sometimes
could be.
True crime, sometimes I'm like, if I wrote that in a book,
No
one would believe that. They'd say this is unrealistic.
They'd say you need to tone that down a bit.
Exactly. So I'm very aware that there is that like anxiety about true crime as entertainment. And when I talk about true crime having inspired elements of my books, I would never like exactly say which case it is, or because I'm very aware that those are real people with real families and they're not for me to draw inspiration from. For me, it's more like the procedural around it, like how police deal with a certain case that I sort of borrow from. But yeah, I mean, all that to say that I'm aware that there's an uncomfortable line. I haven't got the answer for you other than maybe there is something deeper in the urge to watch true crime that isn't just entertainment.
Yeah, and it sounds like there's certainly something to learn.
Mm.
We've arrived at your fifth and final bookshelfy pick now.
I've even forgotten what book I picked.
It's The Hunger Games.
Oh, The Hunger Games.
That felt like a game show as well. It's The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. One of the most popular YA book series of all time, with a 2012 film adaptation, of course, starring Jennifer Lawrence. The Hunger Games is widely considered a classic of modern dystopian fiction. 12 boys and 12 girls are forced to appear in a live event called The Hunger Games. There is only one rule: kill or be killed. When 16-year-old Katniss Everdeen steps forward to take her younger sister's place in the games, she sees it as a death sentence. But Katniss has been close to death before. For her, survival is second nature. It feels really fitting to have an iconic YA series.
Oh,
as
I had to.
On your list, given your own writing. Why is this your go-to recommendation?
Because it's The Hunger Games. I don't know what to say beyond... I just love this book and this franchise. And I think again, you know, when I said about people look down on the interests of teenage girls and often... But I think that also sort of applies to YA fiction. Yeah. A lot of people will look at it as though it's lesser somehow than adult fiction. Even though, as someone who writes both... I actually think writing YA is harder because teenagers are paying attention when they read, unlike adults sometimes who are just half paying attention, thinking about taxes in the back of their mind. I never think about taxes. So I worry that a lot of people think that YA fiction isn't or is somehow less than. And The Hunger Games, I have to say, is like a perfect A to Z. Oh my God, Z, I'm turning American. I literally am turning American sometimes.
No, but you're talking about The Hunger Games.
Yeah, it's forgivable, guys. A to Z. And I said trunk earlier as well, I'm sure.
Well, instead of boot.
Yeah, I really am. I don't sound American because I write American these days. Mm-hmm. My vocabulary is changing. I know, it's terrible. I'll go home and read a thesaurus.
But you have very much picked yourself up on it.
Yeah,
I know.
I am nothing but self-critical. The Hunger Games is... perfectly structured. And novels don't necessarily have to be as tightly structured as a TV show or a movie. But I very much approach writing my books as a screenwriter. Like I think in a four-act structure, I make sure that my midpoint twist hits around the 50% mark. I'm very upset if it's more than like 3% either way. I'm very strict that way. And I think the Hunger Games is such a great example of what like tightly plotted like act structure, what it can do in a story. And sort of if people think that sticking to the three-act structure, you worry that your book is going to be formulaic or boring, I just point to The Hunger Games and be like, no. That was new. That was novel. Like that completely changed publishing forever because of how amazing and different it was. It sticks to the 3X structure like within a percentile. It's like perfectly structured. So for me, yes, it's sort of like a nerdy macro thing that I love that it is such a well-structured book. And yet it's so new and exciting. And like, it, yes, within that structure, it still feels like a breath of fresh air. Or did. It was, I will remind you, it was the first of its, not the first of its kind, but it set off a wave of other dystopian YA books. But The Hunger Games is the original of my heart and soul.
It completely resets expectations of what YA fiction could be and explore.
I don't think that YA books, again, pulling this out of nowhere, but I don't think that we could just liberally kill off teenagers so much
until
Suzanne came and paved the way for us.
Yeah, the fact that we could then in YA explore violence, politics,
it pushed boundaries,
emotional depth. Yeah.
And I'm glad those boundaries got pushed because I do a lot of boundary pushing as well in YA fiction, so I'm glad that Suzanne was there to pave the way.
She did.
But it, on top of just it being structurally really impressive, I also think that Katniss herself as a protagonist is a breath of fresh air, where a lot of the YA fiction of that time really didn't do complicated girl main characters. They really weren't allowed to have flaws and be messy and make mistakes. Other than, oh, she's clumsy. Like, that's not a character flaw. That's just, like, we're all clumsy. Yeah. Whereas Katniss, for me, like, in the first book, the complicated choices that she makes, and she's selfish at times, and she has PTSD, and she makes bad choices, like, throughout the series, not just the first book. And to me, I think that, A, was something else that was such a boundary pusher that we hadn't really seen in YA fiction up to that point. And as someone who only wants to write messy female protagonists who make bad choices and are selfish and are unlikable at times because it's more fun.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much that I don't think I'd be able to get away with it. I mean, I still get a lot of criticism for it, but I think that Katniss Everdeen paved the way for that sort of protagonist, and I'm very happy that she did.
Thank you to Suzanne Collins.
Thank you for your service.
She was also very heavily involved in the film adaptation of The Hunger Games. How has the TV adaptation process been for you? You sort of mentioned the difference between a day on set versus a day spent writing.
Yeah. For me, season one was slightly different because I wasn't writing it. So I was an exec producer, so I would get sent the scripts and I would give notes on them. They weren't necessarily always done. So the finished product is not something that I would say is how I would have adapted it. And if fans feel that it's different from the book, know that I tried behind the scenes a lot. I tried a lot to gear it to something that, you know, I wanted to see as an adaptation. So with season one, it was a steep learning curve in that regard. But I sort of used all that to maneuver my way in season two so that I'm the one writing it. So season two is exactly like my vision of what an adaptation is and should be because I wrote all of it. But and that's not to say it's exactly what the book is, because I think adaptations do need to be different from the book, because if you just think, if very in simple terms, Pip spends a lot of time researching stuff on her computer.
Can't
in the
watch
book,
that.
It would be so boring. It would literally be so boring. So you have to come up with ways of making scenes in real life and create new obstacles and think, okay, how can we turn this into a set piece that has like an action sequence? So for me, I think season two is incredibly faithful to the book. Like, there's exact lines and scenes taken exactly from the book, but I've had a lot of fun of bringing it to life in a way that the book couldn't ever be. Like, we don't necessarily just follow Pip's perspective. We follow another character that I would never be able to do in the book.
Yeah, it goes both ways. It opens doors as well.
Yeah. Which to me, I don't think feels like it's straying away from the book. It's sort of what could have been going on in the book. We just don't know because we weren't privileged to that point of view. So yeah, I've had a lot of fun and hopefully managed to keep in a few surprises, even though it is just the same as the book. I've kept a few little twists in there to keep readers on their feet.
When you're writing books now, are you thinking in the back of your mind, oh, what this could be if it was on screen?
I guess it's not necessarily that perspective, but I've always written all of my books with the film movie structure, like three act structure in mind. I don't think about them in like episodes, like, oh, that's where you would end episode one. But I guess I do naturally try to end my chapters with a cliffhanger. And often those are the parts that you repurpose as an end of episode hook. So it's not that I am picturing it and thinking, oh, how would I adapt this? It's just that to me, the story is the story. And even though I'm writing it as a book, it's the same way I would probably structure it if I were now writing an original movie or a TV show. Another thing is that now every time I think of the characters from A Good Girl's Guide to Murder, I am picturing the actors.
Of course.
I can't picture anything else.
Because you've seen them.
I've seen them in the flesh.
They exist.
I know. Pip is just Emma Myers to me. I can't undo that. It's done now. Done deal.
But you are still writing for the page at the point of writing it.
Yeah, for sure. Writing books is different than writing screenplays. I get in a lot of trouble when I say, writing screenplays is actually easier than writing books. They have to do a similar level of work beforehand. But when it comes to actually writing on the page, books are having to do so much more. Like we talked about with Toni Morrison, like you have to completely take readers on a journey and the sentences have to sound good and they have to make the reader feel the thing. That is so much harder than just writing Pip cries and then letting Emma Myers, the actress, do all the work for me in crying. And the way that humans work is when you see a human upset, your mirror neurons are firing and you start to feel upset because you see a human being upset. Like TV, at least for my part in the TV show, that's easier for me because I don't have to do that heavy lifting. I put it in the script. The actor and the director are the ones that have to make it work. When it's the book, I am the actor, the director and the writer. I have to do all of that work.
And the set
creator. God, I've got so many jobs.
The world building, which we've actually talked about in all of the books that you've brought. I mean, particularly Victorian London, for example.
Oh, I love it.
If you're writing a script, you don't have to worry about creating
and
that.
And my
so
scripts
palpably.
Are very lean on that as well. When other scripts, people will describe their characters more, like what they're wearing. You can tell with my scripts, I don't care. I'm like, unless it's plot important, I literally don't mention clothes. I talk about feelings and they're in Pip's bedroom. Literally never, I'd never describe a room. So yeah, that's not even down to me. Obviously, as a producer, I can then be like, oh, let's change the costume. Well, let's see what we've got. But yeah, script-wise, I'm very much focused on like feelings. It's other people's job to do all that other stuff.
Well, it's your job now to choose one book as a favourite from your five bookshelfy picks today.
That's so mean.
I know.
You can't do that.
I am going to.
But The Hunger Games is in there. That's too basic for me to pick.
Just described it. It's hard as well because the order does kind of affect how you might feel about them.
I'm going to have to pick Toni Morrison's Beloved because I think that's like the most special book. And I feel like I read it at a time and it taught me. Oh, it's so difficult.
It sounds like they've all taught you so much, actually.
They have. I've selfishly picked the books that I think made me want to become a writer and hopefully made me better at it.
Which is a really great approach to this.
Yeah, but it's not necessarily what you asked for, so sorry.
Take them all if you want to take them all.
I've taken your homework assignment and I've changed it to what I wanted. But yeah, I think I'd pick Beloved.
Okay.
But then obviously followed by The Hunger Games. Oh God. Sorry, Suzanne.
I'm sorry to have made you do
that. Yeah, that really is your fault.
But I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Such a lovely time.
It's been lovely.
Thank you.
Let's both get back to being creative and disgusting.
And disgusting. Yeah. Emphasis on the disgusting.
I'm Vic Hope, and that was Bookshelfy from the Women's Prize, supported by Bailey's and produced by Birdline Media. Thanks for joining me for this episode. You'll find all the books that we discussed in our show notes. There's also a link to our bookshop.org shelf where every purchase supports independent bookshops and the work of the Women's Prize Trust, a charity helping build a better future by championing women's writing. Now remember to hit the follow or subscribe button so you never miss an episode. And if you liked this one, then leave us a rating or review to help other readers discover even more brilliant books by women. I'll see you next time.